Well, I was going to amaze you and say that I have prepared notes,
mm-hmm.
but it's more a case of I started to prepare notes. So since we last spoke,
mm-hmm.
much has happened.
Yes.
Much has happened. And I know we traditionally start with what I always accidentally call feedback, but you call follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a very exciting follow-up.
Oh, yes.
Because the podcast is now like public and people have listened to it.
Yes,
it is. So it's no longer just you correcting yourself and flogging yourself for mistakes you've made. Mm. You can now flog yourself for mistakes other people have found.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I can get feedback from everybody out there in the world. But yes, it is public. It is out there, which is a big relief to finally have it kind of out in the world instead of just a little project between the two of us. So what are some of your notes then? Let's start out with your preparations. What have you done?
Well, I thought we might maybe talk about some of the content of the episodes, but first deal with some of the sort of general
mm-hmm.
feedback and follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot of it has just been, it's been really positive for a start. It's been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mainly been, people saying how wonderful you are, which is fair enough. But
there are Brady fans. I've seen in the comments, Brady fans.
Yeah, there are a couple out there, but there has been a criticism of me.
What is
and
that?
I'd like to, and I think it's something worth addressing or discussing
mm-hmm.
at least.
Mm-hmm.
And this was this feeling that it's basically me asking you a bunch of questions
mm-hmm.
and you talking a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we should discuss that.
Oh, yeah? What do you have to discuss about that? I'm curious from your perspective.
Well, there's a few points.
Yeah.
The first point is I completely agree.
Mm-hmm.
It is for the most part me just asking you questions. But I think that's kind of the way it should be to a large extent. And I mean, you and I discussed this before we even started, the nature of whether or not, you know, I'm asking you questions and how much I rabbit on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And for the record, I mean, you've always said you want to hear a lot from me. You
mm-hmm.
know, you don't just want me to ask you questions. But I think it was always going to be that way. This plays to our strengths. This is the way we are, isn't it? I mean, you are like a talker, communicator type person. I mean, you used to be a teacher, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
And I am a question asker. You know, I'm a journalist by training. So you put two of us in a room, one guy who has lots of things to say and knowledge and likes to communicate it, and another guy who likes to like ask questions and find things out from people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's gonna happen that way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're partly right, and part of the reason that I wanted to work with you on this is I do think that you are the best interviewer person I have ever come across. And for those of you who have ever seen Brady's YouTube videos, he's always interviewing somebody else, and he does the editing, and he often cuts out his own questioning part. But I have seen it happen live a couple of times, and you really work some magic with the interviews. Like that is just your skill. But even when we're just hanging out and just talking, not recording, you know, if we're just having a drink together or something, you're still the same way. Like that is fundamentally your personality, is to ask questions. And it's funny to hear you describe me as a talker, because I normally think of myself as a very quiet and reserved person because I spend most of my time not talking. But I am also completely aware that I can get on a roll that is just a little too long. And so I can definitely need someone to help guide me through the parts that are terribly uninteresting.
I mean, you are a quiet person and you are like a reserved guy. That's true. But once you're with your mates and people you're friendly with, I think you're pretty comfortable talking.
Yeah, then I blossom.
I did read one comment in a review, though, that I did find funny.
Yeah.
Where someone sort of said that they felt like I was here to ground you.
Yes, I saw that same one, and I thought, that is exactly right. I think.
Really? I found it funny for another reason, because you must be one of the most calm, grounded people I know, whereas I'm a bit all over the place. So the idea of me grounding you actually made me chuckle, whereas you're normally sort of the calming influence and someone who gives me good advice and things like that. So I like the idea of me being this calming influence all of a sudden. Anyway, that they were the things I had to say about the mm-hmm. the questioning. What have you thought? What have you, you've been obviously reading through some of the, you know, the early comments and the feedback. Has anything sort of caught your eye?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. It's always really nerve-wracking when you have a new project and you want to launch it out into the world and see what people think about it. And I have to say, it has been a much more positive experience than I was expecting. Like, we were doing really well in the download numbers, and we're just getting a lot of positive comments. And we have a ton of positive reviews on iTunes. And if you want to discuss any of these episodes in particular, or to leave a comment on one of the episodes, for now, we're having all of the discussion happening on my subreddit. So if you go to Reddit, reddit.com/r/CGP Grey. There'll be a discussion thread in there for each of the episodes that we can put up. And if you want to leave feedback, for now, that is probably one of the best places to do so. I do go through that and read all the comments, and I'm very interested to see what people have to say about this little project so far.
You're really interactive there too, I've noticed. I think we might talk about sort of comments and feedback later, mm-hmm. if we get time, but mm-hmm. I have noticed on the subreddit you're very interactive. It's a, you know, with the people, with the community.
Yes. Well, yeah, I do. That's one of the reasons why I'm very happy to direct feedback to Reddit, because unlike YouTube and unlike other places, I find it really manageable to try to have conversations with a larger number of people. We do have it scheduled at some point. I want to talk about comment systems in general, so I don't want to discuss that too much right here. But the short version is that it's really easy on Reddit to get a sense of what people are saying and to have feedback and interactions with a bunch of people. So I think it's the best place to go for now.
It's a good community too, the Reddit community. Like, it's like, you know, you'll get funny stuff and you'll get love and you'll get hate, but it's always quite smart and they seem like good people on Reddit in a lot of ways. They seem like my kind of people when I read the comments there, as opposed to comments on a lot of other social media.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as with absolutely everything, it always it depends on the section that you're going, but I would agree with you as a general statement there.
Actually, that's true. My Reddit, I'm quite narrow in my Reddit, in the subreddits I go to. So yeah, I should be careful what I say. Let me ask you about something else.
Mm-hmm.
The Hello Internet logo.
You mean the artwork?
Yeah, the little HI. I know you sort of sent me a few ideas beforehand, and you know, then you kind of just went off and did your thing. But
I believe what happened was I sent you them, you didn't like them, and then I used it anyway. I think that is actually the process by which that unfolded.
I don't mind. I quite like the HI one you've gone with, and I quite, because I sometimes look at it. You know how when you look at something for a long time, you suddenly see it differently, and I suddenly see the sort of the gray lines going up into the white block to make the high and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not too sure about that little border you've got on it though.
Yeah, the border I might have to change, but I listen to a lot of podcasts, as I've mentioned before, and I'm always aware that the artwork seems to be designed for a really big screen. But you actually look at it as like a little 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter image on your phone. So yeah. I was trying to go for something that was very visually immediately recognizable and sort of would try to catch people's attentions. And I think that kind of works.
Yeah.
And also the dark gray color was not really used by very many podcasts. So I thought I'd go with that. For obvious also reasons, but I have to say it did look good. It did look good when we were sort of dominating the iTunes charts for a while. And, you could just see like all these little high logos all over the place for the number one podcast in various countries.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that it worked very well like that. I thought it was really eye-catching.
Well, if anyone wants to put any comments about it, I'd be really interested to read it, because at the moment it's just you and I talking. But
yeah.
I do wonder what people think about it. So some follow-up from episode 3,
mm-hmm.
which was the work-life balance, 4 light bulbs.
Yes.
Your 4 light bulbs thesis.
Yeah.
Have you had any reflections on it? Anyone said anything to you about it?
Well, I want to start off by saying it was really interesting listening to that when I was editing the podcast for release. Listening to it a second time, it was really clear how we each think about work in very different ways.
Do you think?
It came across very much to me anyway that you are dealing much more with kind of work in parallel with other things maybe than I am. And I was thinking of work as like chunks of time, like very clearly dedicated to one task. And I think it's interesting, you know, whenever we or other YouTuber guys get together, it is interesting how we are all sort of doing the same thing, but each one of us does it in very different ways. And I think you could hear that a little bit in the previous episode. Mm.
But I don't know how much of that might be the extent to which I was being devil's advocate at times, but mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you say that. I don't really know what to make of that.
The other thing I would just say is that, again, from the Reddit thread, it was interesting to see. There's this issue with analogies and, like, boy, and I think I said it a little bit at the beginning, but boy, that analogy, there are definitely a lot of problems with that analogy, right?
You might have to revisit it.
Yeah.
You might have to refine it.
Yeah, I figure, you know, well, you know, productivity is probably a thing we're going to come back to at some point, so I don't really want to dwell on it.
Episode 10, it will be doing like the 8 light bulbs.
Yes. Yeah, maybe. But I just want to say that my favorite piece of feedback came from Henry, he of the Minute Physics fame. And Henry just sent me a little email, and all it said was, "I think you forgot that light bulbs can be wired in parallel," which is like a devastating remark to make to someone who has taught physics. It's like, yes, I totally understand that this analogy does not work from like a straight up, I actually have a battery and I actually need to light up some light bulbs.
That is a very Henry comment though, isn't it? Like,
yeah. And the very Henry thing is, I'm going to now just fully embarrass him as well, is later on, it was just today, but it was a couple of days later, he wrote me a much more in-depth email about how the analogy also fails, because I should really be thinking about it in terms of electromotive force and the voltage and the resistance in the individual light bulbs. And so he was really thinking that one through to its absolute conclusion. Henry was doing the advanced version of what I saw many people in the comment thread talking about, which is that there are lots of problems with that analogy, and I will fully admit to some of those, though I still think my core idea of the trade-off still holds. But like
isn't,
I said,
isn't the latest Minute Physics video that just went up in the last day or two about light bulbs?
Oh, I don't know.
I think it is. This is embarrassing.
I don't know.
I think you may have inspired him. I know you've been in a cave and not looking. But I think his latest video is about light bulbs. I'll have to check that. I could be wrong.
Right.
My favorite comment in relation to, you know, unpicking the argument or discussing the merits of the light bulb analogy was someone who pointed out that if you improve aspects of your life, like your health, for example, that actually increases the power of your motor and lets you do other things with your other light bulbs, which is something we never discussed.
Yes, yes. And I saw a couple comments like that, and I totally agree with that as well, right?
That was interesting.
I think there is also something to just be said that people just have kind of intrinsically more or less powerful motors than each other in this analogy, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's why I always look at you, and you, from my perspective, are just this incredible YouTube work machine. And I think, like, boy, I do not have the same kind of wattage output that you seem to have. And
one. If you came and watched me work for a day, you would think differently.
I'm not so sure about that, but I did agree with those comments, right? That, and I was sort of working towards it at the end of the podcast, that at a certain level, you know, you can invest more into one area and then get more out in total. But I do think there are situations in which that's very hard to do. But yeah, obviously. If your health is at its peak, you are able to accomplish much more in all of the other areas. And the reverse, of course, is not true as well.
Did Mrs. CGP Grey listen to the podcast?
At this point, she has listened to the first two, but she has not yet listened to the third one.
The one I want her to listen to.
I know. And I mentioned her in that one, and I tried to prod her a little bit, but I was like, oh, you know, I mentioned you in the third one. But she has been she's been very busy with some other projects at this point. So she will listen to it at some point, but has not yet at this stage.
Well, let me tell you, Mrs. Periodic Videos, or Number File, or whatever I'm supposed to call my much better half, did listen to episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
We went for a drive that by coincidence coincided with the exact length of the podcast. So I said, let me play you this. So we played it for the drive. Mm-hmm. I was utter silence throughout. I think the only time she spoke during it was at one point admiring Mrs. Gray's patience. What a patient woman she must be.
I think
that was during the time when you were talking about how you completely blank her for 3 days when you're putting a video out.
Mm-hmm. That just happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. But and then amazingly, it just finished as we got to the car park where we were going to, which was nice timing. So we pulled up, and I sort of turned to her and said, "What do you think? What do you think about that?" The main thing that came across was that she would quite like to sit down with you and discuss a few of the items,
mm-hmm.
in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, because she's into all that stuff you're into, like workflows and sleep patterns and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, I think she disagreed, mm-hmm. with your thesis. And her best argument, which she didn't really make, but she didn't need to make against your argument, was herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's just sort of sitting there, and we're talking here about how you can't do all four things at once.
Right.
And then I look at her, and she works really hard in a really demanding job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's like, I mean, you know about her. She's got this amazing job and she gives so much to that. She always, every day, makes time for her friends and rings them and talks to them. She's a brilliant family person and talks to her mum and dad all the time and takes great care of me. She's incredibly healthy and goes to the gym all the time and her personal, mm-hmm. trainer every week, and she watches what she eats and she always looks amazing. And she does all these things, like, to the maximum. And then she's just been spending an hour listening to you and I grumble about, oh, I can't eat healthy and do my job at the same time. And I think she is the embodiment of the argument against us. But anyway, right,
so
it did amuse me.
Mrs. Numberphile is the counter argument.
Yeah.
I will just try to defend myself. I will go back to some people's engines are more powerful than others.
Yeah, and you and I are just puttering along on these old bomb of a car, and she's a Rolls Royce.
This is, yeah, I think that might be the conclusion that we need to come to, is that Mrs. Numberphile has a very powerful motor compared to the two of us. So that might very well be the case.
But I think she does want to sit you down and talk through a few points, so we'll arrange that sometime.
Oh, good. Okay.
I tell you what else bothered me. Was it in episode 3 where you did that, you clarified this whole infringement versus theft thing when it comes to copyright?
Mm-hmm.
That still bothers me a bit too.
That still bothers you?
Yeah, I just think you're being so, like, you're being a bit overly cautious saying, it's not theft, it's not stealing.
I could not disagree with you more at this point. I fully understand that I can be overly pedantic about things like this, but I'm going to very strongly disagree with you there.
So someone comes into my house, takes my TV and watches a few programs on it and then puts it back later that day, have they infringed on my TV or have they stolen it?
Wait, what? The person breaks into your... Well, first of all, they broke in and entered into your house.
But if they didn't take any money or break anything, have they just infringed into my house?
I don't think that's an appropriate analogy. I don't think this lines up at all. I think you're trying to stack the deck in your favor with that one, buddy.
Well, I don't know. You've already said that you're no good with the analogy, so. Anyway, I just listen back to it and I think, go on. They're stealing from you. They're stealing. They're thieves.
I disagree. I think infringement is a word that the internet culture needs to make happen as a common understood word, like theft is a common understood word.
But I think infringing is like, using the word infringing is like dressing something bad up to make it sound not as bad. Why can't we give it a more emotive word? Why do we, because infringing is just like, it's such like a delicate thing. Like, you know, Germany didn't infringe on Poland, did it? Like, you know, like you don't.
No, but that is also not a comparable analogy.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is Germany, if you said infringe, it makes a terrible thing sound, you know, somewhere near more acceptable. And I don't think it is acceptable. And I don't think we should be giving them this delicate word when they're doing a bad thing to us.
I was going to say, it's the word. Unfortunately, these words aren't perfectly comparable, but you do also have the word piracy, which is a similar.
That's a better. See, word. That's an emotive word. I like that.
But yeah, it is a more emotive word. But that is usually piracy is talking about individuals making copies for themselves. And so they're engaged in piracy, which it is more emotive, but it is almost more emotive in a very cool kind of way, right? Like,
you know, yeah, it's true.
Pirates have a lot of social cachet these days. I'm not sure it's really dissuading the kids, you know.
All right.
Don't be an awesome, cool pirate. We're going to have to disagree on this.
I want to put the challenge out there, though. I want a new word to describe what you call infringing.
Yeah.
That is more emotive, but, you know, it doesn't cross swords with stealing and theft, which you think is, you know.
All right.
Sacred. But anyway, there
no.
we go.
Yeah, no, we'll see. We'll see if people in the Reddit thread for this video can come up with a better word. So you want something that just sounds meaner.
Yeah, I want a word to describe the practice of other people or organizations taking content and using it for their own purposes.
We'll see if someone comes up with something.
Sorry, I just had to get that off my chest. Any more follow up?
No, but that is the point of follow up, Brady. Right? There's always going to be something that's sticking in your mind, and this is the time to discuss it.
All right.
Hello, Internet. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. It's my job to recommend something interesting to you to listen to, and this week that's going to be A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. Bryson is a travel writer, and this is his experience walking along the Appalachian Trail, which, for those of you who are unaware, is a path in the woods in America that goes from Maine to Georgia, and it's incredibly long and actually genuinely dangerous because it is, of course, nature. The thing that I like about this book is that Bill Bryson is not like a professional adventurous guy. He's a kind of normal homebody sort of person. And so his experience walking along the Appalachian Trail is a lot like what I would imagine if I tried to walk along the Appalachian Trail. Basically kind of a disaster from beginning to end, but a very entertaining story for other people to hear. And it really is an enjoyable tale just from start to finish with him and this friend of his cats trying to do this adventure that they are both clearly not prepared for in any way. I personally had the enjoyable experience of listening to this book on a road trip a number of years ago and actually intersecting paths with the Appalachian Trail, which I decided to get out and explore and also got briefly lost and terrified on. But that's a story for another time. So I'm going to highly recommend this book, and the copy on Audible is also read by Bill Bryson, which he has a good narrating voice. And as I've said in a previous spot, I like it when the author reads their own thing. They put a different spin on it than a professional narrator might. So if you want, you can listen to A Walk in the Woods for free with Audible. All you need to do is go to audible.com/hellointernet, that's all one word, and sign up for a 30-day trial. By using the audible.com/hellointernet link, that's how they know you came from us, which is one of the ways we're going to figure out if this podcasting experiment is a success. So if you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles and virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at audible.com/hellointernet. That's audible.com/hellointernet, all one word.
What's been going on? What's been going on in your life or in my life or any... It's been crazy. Life has been crazy.
Yeah. Life has been crazy for both of us for the past week. Mm. And for you, crazier, I think, because you just got back from Vietnam, did you not?
I did.
And what were you doing on the other side of the world?
I don't know how much you know about my dad, but he was I'm Australian, as you know, but not many American people even seem to realize that Australian soldiers fought in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was an allied force. A lot of people are always really surprised when I tell them that. And my father fought in the Vietnam War. So I've kind of grown up, you know, knowing this and knowing bits and pieces of his stories. So basically the purpose of this trip was to go with him to Vietnam and travel around to some of the places where all the stuff went down. Which was really interesting. It's especially interesting for me because there are two things about my dad that are unusual in this respect. One was he did two tours of the Vietnam War, and the first one was 12 months, which I think was in 1968, I think. Mm-hmm. And then he did another 8-month tour towards the end, which I can't remember the year. It was 71 or I can't remember the year, which is terrible. But that on that first tour, he was a dog tracker. Well, I mean, he wasn't a dog, but he was a dog handler and of a tracking dog. So his war experience was quite different to a lot of other people, insofar as his role was to lead this dog around, sniffing.
And what was the dog doing?
The dog was sniffing enemy forces,
mm-hmm.
Viet Cong or North Vietnamese soldiers. So a typical scenario would be there would be a contact, there would be a battle, and then my dad and his dog, which was called Caesar, would be brought in to sort of sniff and follow the retreating troops and try and, you know, re-engage with them. From a combat sense, he had quite an unusual experience, but he also had a personally very interesting experience because his relationship through the war was more with a dog than with other soldiers in many ways. So it was a very unusual and special relationship. But also, my dad went on to become a journalist and a writer. And once he'd finished his sort of journalistic career, he settled down to writing books, and he's written a number of books about the Vietnam War. And his first one and most successful one, which is called Trackers, is about him and the dog. So I'd heard some of these stories, but not all of them. But then I read this book, which is just crammed with amazing stories that I didn't know. So that suddenly I had all this, you know, all these stories and all this stuff, but I'd still never seen the place or been there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what last week was about. It was about going to the site of these places. And of course, me being me, and Dad quite wanted me to, I took my camera along, and he sort of retold a lot of these stories. And my dad's a really good storyteller.
Uh-huh.
He retold a lot of these stories in the places where they happened, and I rolled the camera over it, and hopefully we'll get around to editing them at some point.
Are we going to see these videos on one of your many channels at some point in the future?
Yeah, I'll probably just put it on a channel called Brady Stuff, which is just a channel where I just dump stuff that hasn't – unbelievably.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but like I've known you for a while, and this is like yet another channel of yours that I have never even heard of existing.
Well, this is the channel where I put things that haven't got a channel. Unbelievably, okay. There are some topics that I haven't got a channel for.
I'm almost surprised that you don't have a dedicated Vietnam War channel, for example.
That's not a bad idea, actually. Maybe I'll like, no.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'll probably pop them on there or something. But anyway, mm-hmm. It's, you know, by the by, I mean, for me, it wasn't so much about making videos.
Mm-hmm.
It was about, you know.
Yeah, spending some time with your dad and hearing his
experiences. Time with
his
my dad and it's always good to put, you know, to visit places and really, it gives you a different understanding of stuff, whether it's something intense like the Vietnam War or going to the Eiffel Tower, you know, mm-hmm. when you visit to the real place, you kind of can think, oh yeah, now I understand the geography and.
Yeah, it's always fundamentally different. No matter how much you hear about a place, when you go, it's just a different experience.
Yeah.
It's a much more human experience to be there and to stand in the place where something actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was kind of crazy, but it was good fun.
I'm glad you came back alive.
Yeah, you were just worried we wouldn't finish the podcast series if I got some malaria or something, weren't you?
Yeah, that is exactly true. And I was nervous when you tweeted that menu that had intestines and a bunch of other terrifying foods on it.
Yes.
And I thought
it had a rectum on it, didn't it?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
it was rectum, and I was thinking, please, Brady, do not become terribly sick or die on this trip. It would be terribly inconvenient, but I'm glad you're back safe and sound.
I've never eaten so much squid in all my life.
Oh.
But they love their squid there.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing that was really interesting, though, was that it was really interesting to go to a place in that kind of military tourism context
mm-hmm.
where – I don't know, for lack of a better term, you're on the losing side.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, the US and Australians and the Allies withdrew from Vietnam, and the North Vietnamese came down and
mm-hmm.
and took the country, so to speak. And you know, it's now this country that it is, this communist country, and the war is a great victory for them.
Mm-hmm.
And to go there and be doing the sights and be taken around by a tour guide when of the force that was not victorious was very interesting, and it's also different, you know. We're used to going to sort of places where terrible things happen, but ultimately, you know, in a victorious context, I
right.
guess. And this was the opposite, which was really interesting.
I wouldn't have thought about that, but that's a good point. Normally when you're doing like the war monuments that, you know, an Australian or an American would tend to go to are they're monuments of triumph. And doing a tour where that was not the case is a different experience.
Yeah. It was also really interesting going to the Vietnamese museum about it. But anyway, you know, it's probably a there's only so much we could talk about Vietnam for in a podcast that's more about, I don't know what this podcast is about, but it's probably not about war stories. So
this podcast is about what we wanted to be about. So
all right,
so there you go. Vietnam totally counts, and I was
Vietnam,
I was
and I did curious. And I did make videos there. So it is about filmmaking. I tell you what, from a filmmaker YouTube perspective, it's really hard to make videos of your dad. I'll tell you that right now.
Why?
Partly because of the way my dad is, but also just because there's a different dynamic. I mean, you know, when I'm interviewing someone or filming something, the video is them, but I can take control to an extent and guide them with the questioning. And if they've got a certain point they want to make or a way they want to tell the story, and I don't think it's going to work, I can either delicately shepherd them with my questions, or I can be more frank and slap them around the ears and say, no, we need to do it like this. But my dad obviously had, you know, stories he wanted to tell and ways he wanted to tell them. And they didn't always fit with what I thought would work in a video.
Mm-hmm.
And all the different techniques I normally use on people to get what I want just didn't work. It was like...
He knows you too well. He's blowing off all your linguistic tricks.
I don't know if it was... But yeah, I felt like there was kryptonite in the air in terms of my ability to... steer the interview either way I sometimes can. It must be because it was my dad, because it never happens with anyone else.
Yeah, I guess you are not in a position of authority when it is your father on the other end of the camera, right?
I guess that's it. I mean, I don't feel like he was in authority over me either, though. I mean, I don't have that kind of relationship with my dad, but yeah, there was just something different. I would stop and ask him questions, and he wouldn't answer them. But he's like that with everyone. He just ignores questions and cracks on with his stories. But yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe he didn't feel sufficiently intimidated or respectful of me as the filmmaker. Whereas everyone else at least has that modicum of respect for me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was still just Brady to him,
mm-hmm.
and he had a story he wanted to tell. And you know, I had stopped the camera a couple of times and said, "Dad, you're not listening to me. You have to answer this question." It was like interviewing a politician when they have what they want to say. But anyway, he is a really good storyteller. He's like famous for his ripping yarns. So he still told the story well, but it was a really interesting interesting thing as a filmmaker for me.
Well, when are you going to get those videos out?
Oh,
long time.
It could be a while because I'm actually jumping on another plane now and I'm going away for a month, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to edit them on the road. So it could be a while, but I'd like to do them soon.
All right. Well, whenever you get around to them, mention it again. We'll put them in the description for the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And, cool. That'd be good.
Today we'll have a description for your – or we'll have a link to your dad's book if people want to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. It is actually a really good book actually. I'm not being – I mean, his other ones I'm not so much into because they're about other soldiers, but the one about him I really enjoyed. But anyway, there we go.
So we'll put it in. People can check it out if they want.
Cool. Thank you. What about you? What's been any news in your world? You had a video out, which is always a big deal.
Yeah, that is really the biggest news ever. It always feels like my whole life just narrows down to the video production in the 4 or 5 days before it actually goes live, and just everything gets postponed. And so there is this cycle in my life where I use this program called OmniFocus to track all of my to-dos. And maybe about 14 days before I'm expecting a video to come out, I start delaying everything in my little program to like after when I think it's going to come out. And so I'm working on the video and stuff comes up in my program and I delay. And then what I'm experiencing right now and what I was doing before I was talking to you is suddenly there's just this monstrous number of things to do after the video comes out. And so I'm sort of overwhelmed with just a very large number of things. But yeah, the getting the video out is the biggest deal. And
it was good, mate. Jury nullification. I liked it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, well, I have to say it is done successfully. Actually, let me open up right now. And
It was 1.2 million last time I looked at it.
That's the one I want to check. So
that's
I have...
just nothing for you, though, is it? That's just
No, I know. Well, this is what I was going to say. So I actually, as you might not be surprised, I have an objective measure about the success of the videos that I use to deem whether or not they have been successful. And so I take whatever my subscriber number at the time of release is as the starting point. So let's just make the numbers easy. I have about 1 million subscribers at this point. And if I have a video that gets less than a third of that number in a week, I would consider that to be just like a total abject failure. If it's more than a third to sort of equal to the number of subscribers, I consider that to be kind of satisfactory. And anything that gets more than the total number of subscribers, that to me is like a very successful video, because that means like people are really sharing it and it like it's going to more people than have signed up to get my videos. So that's always for me the real crossing point is like, can the video get more views than subscribers that I have within a week? And I think it's been 5 days and it is just under the number of subscribers that I have now. So I think this one will limp across that threshold probably before the week goes out.
I've noticed with a couple of your videos lately, actually, the titles have been a little bit more teasy, like a bit more. Is this a coincidence or is this a deliberate thing we're seeing now? They're a bit more like, what's this about? You know, like the law you won't be told and this will hurt and.
Okay, so it's funny that you picked up on that because the answer is that it is partly just a coincidence. The previous video that I did on the nocebo effect, the opposite of the placebo effect, I have a demonstration in the beginning that just does not work if you know what the video is going into it. So I have to not say the name of the thing in the title in that case. With this one, it is a much more teasy title with the law you won't be told. And that is only half a coincidence, but I can't remember exactly where. but some study that was talking about click-through rates for titles, and they were basically saying that teasy kind of titles have surprisingly large click-through rates for what you might expect. And so I thought, let me just try something that's a little bit different. I don't think I will normally do it. I just happen to have two topics that it worked very well with, and so I didn't mind having that back to back. But I am a fan of the straightforward title. Also because that partly does a lot of introduction for you. Like I don't necessarily have to set up as much if the title just straight up says, here's what we're going to talk about. So yeah, it is just a bit of a coincidence. Although I will say just as a personal experience releasing this video, I think in the second episode or somewhere I mentioned how I probably will not do a medical topic for a while. That put me under a lot of stress about sort of feeling like I really need to be correct. I am going to add law to topics that I will not cover anytime soon again if I can possibly avoid it. Right. And it's for a slightly different reason, but so this is entirely a problem with me and also might as well make this a theme, talking about analogies. I tend to think of the law as a kind of computer code for human society. Right, you know, we hear all these rules and we formalize these rules about what should happen under what circumstances, and here's all the exceptions for the consequences if the laws or the rules didn't work out in a particular way. But I know this is not the case when I sit down and think about it, and it's partly because my father is actually a lawyer in the States, and I know through him just how much of the law depends on interpretations of what happens in the courtroom. And it's so much more situational and like, ooh, it depends than you think of the law as being, you know, really clear, or at least I think of it as being that way. And so I cannot tell you how many rounds this script went through where I had very definitive statements that kept having to be kind of modified and qualified and toned down and changed a lot. So I will not do a law topic again if I can possibly avoid it, partly because of that. Like, it's difficult to make definitive statements. And there's a number of places in the video where I'm talking about situations that might occur. And it is like, yes, that might happen the majority of the time, but that, like, there's always going to be a really long list of exceptions. Never mind the fact that in America, the rules are different in all 50 states for how things are handled.
Right.
So I was trying to talk about the most general possible case. But yes, that was stressful. Do not expect a law topic anytime soon, people.
Have you ever been to a trial?
I have never been to a trial in person, no.
You got to do it. I tell you what, one day we must do an episode and I'll tell you some good stories about trials I've been to.
Yeah?
Okay. Court cases are good fun.
That sounds good.
Let me do a clever segue here.
Oh, okay.
Which will both follow on from what we're talking about, uh-huh, promote something, uh-huh, and lead to something I wanted to discuss.
Oh, it's the hat trick of follow-up.
This is a hat trick.
Yeah, the hat trick of segues.
Yeah. Speaking of clickbaity titles for videos, uh-huh, the video that I put up today is called The World's Greatest Autograph Book. Mm-hmm. And it is about something that you and I went to see.
Of course.
A couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about that day trip. So look, yes, at that. I got all three together there. You and I went to the Royal Society,
yes,
in London, which is somewhere I've been wanting to take you for ages. And I've, mm-hmm, been pestering you about it. We finally had the chance to go there. And I didn't want you to do the typical tour. We went down into the vaults, mm-hmm, to see all the treasures and things. I deliberately haven't asked you much about your impression of the visit because, mm-hmm, I wanted to ask you here on the podcast. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I thought it was great. It was great to visit. So I think first, why don't you, because you're better at summarizing this than me, right? Why don't you give a quick summary for people who don't know? Like, what is the Royal Society?
All right. The Royal Society is this organization that's been around since the 1600s, and it was set up by Charles II, I think. I think he was one of these kings.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and basically, it was for the sort of the scientists of the time when science was in its infancy. It was kind of like their club. They've been going ever since. And basically, they elect or decide to make people fellows of this society and join the club. And this has been going on for, you know, 350 years or something like that. And basically, every year a new intake of 10 or 20 people joins this club of uber scientists, still going today. And it's just got all this history. They've also been involved in, you know, publications. They have their own journal and they have meetings and they have all these other functions. It's not just a place where they go and have a cup of tea and smoke a pipe. But I should say, yeah, that came out wrong, but anyway, I meant that in a more English sense.
Yes.
But anyway, so it's this club that's been going for years. It's got all this history, you know, any scientist who's anyone has been a fellow of the Royal Society, mm-hmm, Isaac Newton, you know, all those guys, Hooke and Boyle back then, all the way through to your modern greats. You know, Einstein was a fellow, Niels Bohr, all the way through to Peter Higgs and people like that today, mm-hmm, Watson and Crick. They've all been part of this club, so it's got this incredible history. Mm-hmm. The thing about the autograph book is, of course, anyone who becomes a fellow, they all sign the same book, which has been around since the start. So that's why I call it the world's greatest autograph book, because it's got everyone from Isaac Newton through to all your modern day scientists all signing this one book, which is incredible.
Yes.
And of course, any king or queen that comes to the throne is automatically the patron of the Royal Society. So every famous royal has signed it as well. It's this amazing document. But anyway, because of this history and basically all the scientists involved, their interactions are all kept and all their papers and artifacts are kept there in these vaults. It's this real treasure trove of material as well. And I know you love old stuff, and I know you love source documents and things like that. You know, you don't want any secondary sources when you see GP Grey.
No, of course not.
So I thought, I've got to get Grey in there to see all this stuff, because I know you like hanging out in libraries and stuff as well.
Yes.
So we finally went there, and I thought it was going to blow your mind. And I don't know if you were just being calm, or you were lukewarm about it. What did you think? You just kind of.
Oh no! I think I really liked it. I thought it was really interesting to see. So, when we went on a tour, we got to go downstairs into the vault below, and basically see all of the original documents. And it's almost hard to describe because there was such a great variety of things down there. But if you imagine this huge vault, and it would just have the original written letters from all of these famous scientists, right, to the Royal Society, or from explorers who were writing in about, you know, what they were seeing in new places. And it was almost just very overwhelming in the amount of stuff that is there.
All handwritten too, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the thing.
It's a letter from Isaac Newton. Oh, what's he got to say from it?
I did tell my wife when we came back, like, I know it was all in this vault, but it was like shockingly casual, some of the stuff that was just, laying around. The archivist, who was nice enough to give us a tour, I kept saying to him, like, it makes me nervous, like, looking at all this stuff. You know, the one example, was the death mask for Isaac Newton. So the clay, I guess it was. I'm not sure what the material was.
Yeah.
That they put over his face after he died, you know, to get a print of his face. Oh, it's just like there on the shelf, you know. Like waiting to be knocked over by, you know, some clumsy idiot like me who's wandering around and not paying attention.
I'll tell you a quick interjection here. Rupert, yeah. Who's the other guy that works in the library, yes. Who you spoke to briefly, but he wasn't the one that came down with us. He normally is the guy that has to handle that mask. Mm-hmm. And he's done it a few times for me for videos and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he has a recurring nightmare all the time that he drops that mask and it shatters, like it haunts him.
Yeah.
And every time I ask him to pick it up, like he goes a little bit white and tells me, you know about my dream, don't you? So you're not the only one who worries about that.
Yeah. So that was one of my prevailing feelings there, was just like worry for all of these objects. And we were talking about how, you know, some of the stuff like that mask has been digitized. You know, they've done high resolution 3D scans of that. But there's just so many papers and documents that they don't have any other copies except the ones that are in that vault. And it was very interesting. And, one of the examples that was given is like, you don't know necessarily how this stuff is going to be valuable in the future. And the example that was mentioned was talking about they have, you know, all these records of the weather, you know, going back for hundreds of years, which just sounds like the most boring thing in the whole wide world, right? Until, you know, that stuff starts to matter when people are doing, research for the global weather system. And now you actually want that kind of data to be available.
And you've got like the sea levels from Australia from, you know, 1800 and things.
Yeah. All of this stuff that just seems, just so random and so bizarre. Like, I can't even remember we looked at that book. Maybe you can remind me what the deal was, but it was a book and it had collections of drawings of a volcano that some member of the Royal Society had paid a monk to take to go.
It was Vesuvius, wasn't it? It was Vesuvius.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. It was Vesuvius.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the members had paid this monk, you know, in the days before photography, to go outside every day and sketch what Mount Vesuvius looked like, what the volcano looked like.
Yeah, like the plume of smoke, how it was changing shape and things. Yeah.
And send it to him. As we said, like it was like the 1700s version of a webcam.
Yeah.
Right? Where the webcam takes a picture every 30 minutes, but you can't have a webcam. You just have a monk and you pay him some money and he sends you a sketch every day. And that was just, you know, collected in this book. It was really interesting to see.
It was funny. We went with our friend Angela from Google, mm-hmm. and I did find it funny when we were down there because I just love all that old stuff and the romance of it. But you and Angela, who are both much more kind of digital people, all you could think about was, has this been scanned, or who should scan this, and where could this be preserved electronically? And whereas I was like, oh, let's touch this. Oh, doesn't this smell wonderful?
That is true. That is true. You had your hands all over everything. I was surprised to know that it is okay to handle these materials just like with your gross monkey hands, like with all their sweat on them and dirt. And they're like, oh, no, don't worry. You know, you pick up these letters from Robert Hooke. That's totally fine. Don't worry. And they're originals. We don't have any extra copy, but we're going to let you just touch them.
And they prefer you to not use gloves, which is the secret no one tells you.
Yes.
Because because if your gloves, you kind of lose that dexterity and that touch, and you're more likely to drop something or rip something.
Yeah, you end up being more likely to damage it, which is surprising. Mm. And another example of how things in TV and movies are not accurate representations of real life. The one thing that was a very almost overwhelming moment was being able to see the kind of original edition of Isaac Newton's Principia Mathematica, you know, the book that is basically the founding stone of much of modern physics. And that was really amazing to be able to see and to be able to actually hold in my hands. And I made you take a picture of that.
I know. I knew you liked that when you asked for a photo.
Yeah. And honestly, it was only because I saw you going around touching absolutely everything and handling stuff and like, whoops, almost dropped it, you know. that I had the bravery to ask if I could hold that book, and I could not believe it when I said yes, you can hold it, because to be clear, this is Isaac Newton's seminal work, and that copy, it wasn't just a first edition, that was his handwritten copy in big sections with notes to the printer, and so it's like. That, like, you know, he actually slaved over that book for who knows how long.
Yeah.
And that was the copy that got sent off to the printer, you know, to make the first edition. So it's almost like the zeroth edition of that book.
It's pretty cool.
So that I have to say that was an amazing moment. But my
hope was that, you know, that you would say, oh, I could make a few videos here using all this source material. Like, I want to see some CGP Grey videos, you know, using all these old documents from hundreds of years ago with some new spin on some country or some border or something we'd never realized before.
Yeah, I've got to say it's been running in the back of my mind how to take advantage of that. So I have some thoughts. And I'm also, again, like, I'm really glad to know that resource is there. It's amazing to be able to see the original stuff. But it's also often you come across strange surprises when you're dealing with original materials. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to mention something slightly nerdy here. Mm. But when I was in college, I was rereading the Lord of the Rings series. And I thought, let me start at the beginning. I'm going to start with The Hobbit. And by the way, people, if you haven't read The Hobbit yet, spoiler warning coming up here. So you should pause your podcast now.
Should I take my headphones off? Because I haven't read The Hobbit.
You haven't read The Hobbit? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I haven't read The Hobbit.
Are you serious?
I haven't read Lord of the Rings either. Well, do you think less of me?
I'm just surprised, actually. I don't think it's not that I think less of you. I'm just honestly surprised that you have not read it. Do you know the basic story of The Hobbit?
Yes, I know the basic story.
Okay, so I'm not going to ruin anything with the basic story then. So, and no. You're just going to have to listen to this anyway.
Because
this is what we're doing now.
Okay.
So I figured I'll start at the beginning. I'll read The Hobbit. And I'm reading The Hobbit, and I had read it once as a kid. And I'm going through the book, and everything is totally normal until the pivotal scene between Bilbo and Gollum. And it's the pivotal scene in the book where Bilbo... he sort of steals the ring from Gollum and, you know, makes his way out of the underneath this mountain and escapes.
I did see that in the film. I have seen the first film.
Yeah. So there's like a fight, right? There's
yeah. It's like a battle of wits in a way, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's a preceding thing about it, but there is a, like, a skirmish over the ring.
Okay.
And I'm reading the book and everything is going along totally fine. And then in the book that I'm reading, I was completely blown away because Gollum just hands over the ring, right? Like, no questions asked, none of this skirmish nonsense, just basically straight up gives it to Bilbo and Bilbo walks away. And I was so incredibly confused until I realized that my library actually had a first edition of The Hobbit. And it turns out that this is a change in later editions of The Hobbit. So in fiction, this is called a retcon, when the author goes back and changes something in the earlier material.
It's like a director's cut.
Yeah, to make it match later on with the following stuff.
Okay.
And so this was a case of the very first edition of The Hobbit. There is not this epic struggle over the ring. And in later editions, there is, and Tolkien went back and changed it because he realized that it just didn't make any sense given the books that he was writing in the future. So, so like original copies of things can have very interesting information, but some of the trouble sometimes is knowing that this even exists, right? It, like I would never have discovered this if it just wasn't just for a total accident. And so, yeah, source original materials are just amazing. But as always with libraries, like knowing where to look is half the battle.
Was that valuable, that book, if it was some first edition sitting in your local library?
It's one of those things I've wondered about later on. Like, did they not realize that this was a first edition? Because I'm a member of a library that has a first edition of The Hobbit here. Mm. And that's like kept under lock and key. You know, you can't directly access
that. You should have borrowed that bad boy and not returned it and taken a hit on the fine.
Yeah, I should have if I was thinking it through. I think I was really just more confused about the inconsistencies in the story. And that was just derailing my whole brain. Why doesn't this match up with what I expected to be?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I will definitely take advantage of them when I come across something where I want to be able to see the original stuff. And like I said, I have a couple things in mind, but I don't want to mention anything in particular. But
no.
It was a great trip, and I'm really glad that that you were able to bring me down there and to sort of get access to this because you're a cool person.
I should say, by the way, as well, like, you know, by way of thanks to the library guys at the Royal Society, anyone can go there. Anyone can go there and look at any materials. I mean, not anyone can go down to the vault, but anything from the vault can be brought up to you. So if you go there and, you know, join up and go through the process, no money, just like, you know, prove that you're a real person and not some cowboy, and you want to look at some old handwritten document from Isaac Newton, they'll bring it up to you. They'll show it to you. They want people to go there and use this resource. You know, they want this stuff out there. So if you're ever in London or you're from London and you want to go see this stuff, it's not some exclusive club. Anyone can go and have a look.
Yeah, and the library is really worth seeing as well. Like, it's a beautiful room where they'll bring you off the materials. So it is definitely worth seeing.
Cool. Do you know, well, like, we were going to talk about some stuff today. We like prepared a topic.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to do it? We've been going like nearly an hour.
I think that I'm totally up for doing something that is an actual topic, but it depends entirely on you.
Let's do it, man. Let's do it. I mean, the first couple of podcasts have been like an hour long, but there's no rules about this, is there?
No, this is the internet. Stuff can be as long or as short as you want it to be. There's absolutely no limits on this.
And some of the podcasts you've been putting me onto, because I wasn't as much of a podcast junkie as you, so I've just been listening to ones you tell me to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
They typically go for like 2 hours.
Yeah, some of them are very long. And my personal favorite, but sadly defunct now podcast, Hypercritical, was legendary for going, like, they'd have shows, I'm pretty sure they had shows that topped 3 hours in length because John Siracusa, the star of that show, just had interesting things to say and could say them forever. Like, I'll tell you what,
we have to, in a future episode, do a podcast about podcasts, because there's a few things I want to discuss with you, especially about the podcast you've put me onto, because I've been listening to them a lot and I've got lots of questions and comments and I want to do more about it. But that's not for today, is it?
No, that's not exactly for today.
We were going to talk about feedback. Because I think the rough thinking was, because we've been getting so much feedback in the last week with the podcast, it would be a good chance just to talk about feedback in general.
Yeah, I suspect this is going to be a relatively short topic, which is why I don't mind doing it now. Yeah. But I was just thinking about it earlier, and I think my note says feedback on feedback, and I think that there's some things to be said here. And so I guess just to start it off, what I was thinking about is how, you know, because we're in this amazing world with the internet, you know, and people can put stuff out there, and anybody can comment on it if they want, you know, like, and anybody can make a YouTube video tomorrow and upload it, right? And you can get some comments. And I think it's a very weird situation to have feedback from people that you don't know, and how, as the creator of something, to actually interpret that feedback. I think there's a lot of weirdness that happens here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, because I'm kind of, I don't actually know. I mean, like, do you look at the YouTube comments for your own videos very much? I mean, you're so busy making videos, you probably don't have time to actually
read the comments. No, I do, especially on a new video. So for the first, I'll talk about this a bit more in a minute when I sort of talk to you a bit about some of the things I've been doing lately. But in general terms, I would say I look at the viewer comments on a YouTube video for the first day or 2 days, and that starts to subside then because I do a video almost every day or every 2 days, a new video kind of usurps it, and that becomes sort of the focus of my attention. And, you know, now I have a couple of thousand videos. I don't go back and read all the feedback on all of them.
Yeah.
But for the first day or two, and that's when you're getting the most comments anyway, I am very much across what's being said, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, what about you?
Yeah, well,
I know obviously you have comments under your video, and then you also run your Reddit subreddits, which is where you'd like the feedback to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly it. At this point, at this stage, I don't pay any attention to the comments on YouTube with some of the changes that they made. I don't really like that format.
So you won't even look at it at all? You won't even look?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking now in 2014, and a couple months ago, YouTube changed the way their comment system works.
Yes, they did.
And I was never a huge fan of the comment system before. I wouldn't necessarily say that this new system is worse, but for me, for various reasons, I just find it not really workable.
I would say it's worse, but
yeah. Yeah. We'll have a fuller conversation about this at some point.
Yeah.
But for now, I don't really look at the YouTube comments at all.
Yeah.
And I look entirely at the Reddit comments, and that's what I'm interested in.
Why do you look at the comments? What are you looking for in them?
Well, what's interesting to me. So I have on Reddit, I have a section where I can post the videos and people can discuss them. But I'm very interested also on Reddit when the video gets posted in other sections. So people who don't necessarily subscribe to me on YouTube, who've never seen one of my videos before, they will comment on a video, and that can be interesting to read and to see. Like, someone who's not familiar with my video style, you know, what might they say? One of the reasons why I think the feedback on feedback thing is interesting, because it changes at different scales. When someone's starting out, when they're making things for the first time on the internet, anonymous feedback from strangers is kind of an amazing thing. Now, you know, people can just be like total jerks on the internet. There's no denying that. But it is... it's difficult in real life to ever get genuine, honest feedback from people you know in your life. So, you know, you have friends and you have families, and because you have social obligations to the people in those groups, it's hard to get 100% honest feedback from those people in your life.
Yeah.
Whereas some random person who's seen whatever you've made on the internet and who has no connection to you and isn't even using a real name, there's no reason for them to hold back. You know, they have permission to just be really straightforward in their feedback. And that can be very, very valuable. And I think if you're paying attention to that kind of feedback in the right sort of way, especially in the beginning, you can really try to direct whatever it is you're making in a more positive way.
But how much should you allow yourself to be guided by feedback? It's the politically correct thing to say is, I look at the feedback and my audience is really important, and I want to make what they want, and I will shape and tailor what I do to them. And, you know, I take all their opinions on board because it's really valuable to me.
Mm-hmm.
And to an extent, that is true. And only a fool will completely ignore feedback on what the audience is saying, because we do this for the audience. You know, it's a relationship with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you've got to kind of believe in yourself as well and your vision. Otherwise, you just become some diluted, you know, designed by committee piece of generic rubbish.
Yeah.
And the example I often use in this respect is in the number file videos I make, which are these mathematics videos. Often we need to write on something. And for various reasons, which I've outlined in the blog in great detail, and it was very much thought out, I have people write on these pieces of brown paper with a marker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the first three or four number file videos went up, they had a quite a large audience from the start because I already had an audience from other channels. So I was getting a lot of feedback right from the start. And overwhelmingly, like you wouldn't believe, all the feedback was negative about the brown paper.
Really?
You've got to get rid of it. It's rubbish. Like, and trust me, that was what all the comments were about. And it was very strong. But I really believed in using this brown paper.
I got to say, it's such a trademark of yours now. Yeah, I cannot imagine the number file videos without it.
Exactly. And I felt really strongly about it for various reasons, that it was a good idea and it would work. And there are still people that don't like it, but they're very much in a minority now and I rarely hear anything about it. But there are lots of people who really, really love it. They're mm-hmm. really into it and they've really adopted it. And that was an example of something where if I was going to go with the feedback and be shaped by it, I would have ditched that brown paper very quickly, mm-hmm. definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, no, I think I'm right here. And I think if you are starting out and you get shaped by feedback too easily,
mm-hmm.
you lose your distinctiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think you can look at it and take what you want from it, but you can't listen to it too much. You got to be your own man or woman.
Yeah. And yeah, I wouldn't be arguing for follow the feedback entirely. But I agree with you that you're kind of foolish to not pay attention to it, particularly in the beginning. But I think that brown paper one is a good example because there are things that you have to consider as a creator that might not be obvious to the people watching something.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this was your thought process, but I might guess that you wanted something that was distinct for a visual look, or you wanted something that you're dealing with an abstract channel so that people were writing on a thing and you could see them doing it. I mean, was that
there are probably six or seven reasons, but that is a strong mm-hmm. one. I want it to be sort of, yeah, something tactile and physical
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in on topics that are, yeah.
Yeah. So there's definitely considerations that you have to have as the maker of the thing that are not obvious to the audience. But I think for example, in some of my earlier videos, there were a lot of comments about how the audio quality was just terrible. And there is no denying that. Like that was entirely true. And it's funny because it was not something I was aware of when I made the first couple videos. The very first one was done just by talking straight into the laptop microphone, which is unbelievable to me today. But the comments about the audio quality were something that made me realize, like, ooh, I need to put some time and thought into this if I'm going to make more of these. And so I just bought a cheap USB microphone, and already that makes it so much better. Now I have a bit more professional gear. But I think like feedback for rough edges like that can be very useful, or feedback on people's delivery. So, you know, if you're doing something like we're doing and you're making an explanation video, you want to see how many people seem confused by this in the comments. And that's an indication that maybe this isn't going very well. But I think on the flip side of it as well, what's really useful when you're starting out is like positive comments. Do people actually leave comments who seem to like the thing that you're doing? And if you're getting just no positive feedback at all, right, that's a kind of feedback as well. Like you need to adjust what you're making for the world or do something in a very different way to try to catch people's attention.
Mm.
But what I think is, this is a comment that was made to me by Derek of Veritasium, who might be listening right now. Hi, Derek, if you are listening.
Hey, Derek. What t-shirt are you wearing, Derek? Are you wearing those tight jeans, Derek?
He probably is wearing his tight jeans.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't seen Derek, he's very pretty. He's definitely the prettiest of the educational YouTubers, I think.
But he always wears the t-shirt of your channel when he meets you, which is a class act. Like I met him for like a coffee, and like he turned up wearing a Periodic Videos.
That is very classy. Professor.
And then, like, I'm sure when he meets you, he'll turn up in his CGP Grey shirt. And that's attention to detail, you know.
It is.
Anyway.
That's why he's a successful guy.
Exactly. What was he saying to you?
Yeah, what I was going to say, he made a comment when we were talking once about how the value of positive feedback goes to zero as you are more and more successful.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you think that's the case, but he said that and it was like, man, I could not agree with him more strongly when he mentioned that to me.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean I want everyone to stop leaving positive feedback. But you look at, you're kind of preaching to the choir, aren't you, after a while in terms of, people watching are watching because they like what you're doing.
Yeah. And it's very interesting, just as a little bit of a phenomenon that you have. If you get like lots and lots and lots of positive comments, it does sound weird, but after a while, if you have tons of them, they're not necessarily valuable, right? These are like in aggregate, right? Individually they are, but like what can you draw from that is very hard to say. Like there's not necessarily anything actionable in that, right? Whereas negative comments may still contain information for something that you can change or that you can improve upon. And also the other thing is that, you know, negative comments are the ones that just really stick with you sometimes, you know, especially if there is a kernel of truth to them.
Of course, that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And there was a, I'll see if I can find it for the description, but there was a little webcomic that I saw once where it showed like a guy at work and he's surrounded by all these little speech bubbles of people saying really nice things about him. There's 20 nice things and there's one negative thing. And then the second panel is him after work at dinner time. And the one negative comment is still crystal clear, but all the positive ones have sort of faded away slightly. Yeah. And then the final panel is him, you know, it's at nighttime and he can't get to sleep. And the only thing that remains is that negative comment. And all the positive ones have sort of disappeared.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly like what is engaged in a statement like positive feedback trends to zero, that like the negative stuff really sticks with you, especially if it has some kernel of truth. And you know, that can be very, very hard to deal with, sometimes.
Have you ever had like a negative comment that still sticks with you now?
people can leave comments that really do kind of, stick with you. But
I don't want to ask you too personal a question. And I also don't want to encourage people to go and give you a hard time, but
yeah.
what sort of area of criticism will stick with you more than others? Will it be, you know, I don't like the sound of your voice, or your argument is poor, or you sound like you must be very ugly? Like what are the ones that stick with you?
I think there's a kind of comment that I do see on videos, especially when I'm aware, like if it's on a section on Reddit, for example, where people don't know who I am. I would say the one that I'm okay talking about that I see the most is people will say that I sound really condescending in the videos. And that always gets me because like, boy, my whole point is to not be condescending. Like I'm sort of assuming that the person watching this video might not know very much about this topic. And I want to try to be friendly about that. And that is something that I do think about when I'm recording the actual audio for the video is to try to get takes where I'm not like being an authority talking down to a person, especially because very often I knew almost nothing about this topic 5 weeks earlier. And so like I'm by no means an authority. You know, I've just done a whole bunch of research, but I'm very sensitive to coming off as condescending to people who might not have watched a whole bunch of my videos. So that's a kind of negative comment that I do see repeatedly that I'm aware of and kind of sticks with me, and does affect how I work a little bit.
I mean, you're always going to have that problem though, because if you tell people a lot of clever information that they didn't know before very, very quickly, which is what you do, it makes you appear very intelligent and knowledgeable. And that immediately puts you in a position where people will feel that you're being condescending. You're not, and I know you get around it in all those other ways, but you're always gonna struggle with that.
Yeah,
like,
I am.
It's like if someone goes on a quiz show and they happen to know all the answers, like, well, okay, they know all the answers, and people are going to think, oh, aren't they a know-it-all, and feel really negatively towards them. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I just happen to know the answers, and I've said them quickly.
Yeah. I totally agree with that, but it is something that I'm very sensitive towards about thinking of ways to minimize that in the videos in various ways.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is just, I have a couple of other little thoughts here, and there's do you know who Zay Frank is?
Yes, I met Zay Frank at VidCon.
Oh, did you?
Hmm.
Zay Frank, for those who may not be aware, is sort of the father of the modern internet vlog. You know, if you've seen a video where there's a person's face talking at a camera very quickly and they do jump cuts, like, Zay Frank was the guy who started that. Back in the day,
the Green Brother. He's a real hero of the Green Brothers.
Yeah, yeah. He used to do this amazing thing called The Show, which is so old now in internet terms, but it was just amazing. And then he disappeared mysteriously for a number of years and has recently come back on YouTube. But he did a video, which I'll try to find for the description, where he was talking about comments on videos on YouTube. And he made an excellent point, which I thought was interesting, which is that, of course, the only people who comment are the people who have a strong reaction to the video or whatever it is you've made in one way or another, right? People who really liked it or really hated it. But pretty much by definition, the people who watch a video and were kind of meh, they're probably not going to leave a comment.
Yeah.
And so I had not really thought about that, but it's an interesting point that feedback on anything that you put on the internet is going to be intrinsically biased in two completely opposing directions.
Yeah.
You know, people who love it and people who hate it. And I think you can also see this just in any kind of website that has five-star rankings, where almost all the reviews are either five stars or they're one star, and there's almost no three-star reviews.
Yeah.
Because who is the person leaving the three-star review? And I right? Like, yeah. Oh, I kind of liked it.
It either changed your life for the better or it broke the day you got it and you want to.
That's exactly it. And it's like, oh, I kind of liked it, but I think I'll spend 20 minutes writing a review of this thing that's kind of like whatever. Like, nobody does that. That's nobody. And so I think that's just interesting to keep in mind whenever you're looking over feedback of anything that you have put out there.
I mean,
on the internet.
That's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I guess there is one respect where I hadn't thought of this before, actually, but there is a respect in which I have to follow feedback more interestingly and analyze it more than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the respect in which most of my videos have a third party in them, who is often someone maybe not used to the kind of exposure you get on these YouTube videos.
Yes.
And of course they read the feedback.
Yes.
And I then have to counsel them in some way.
Yes.
So that whole thing about, you know, the silent majority is something I'm always forced to bring up with people when they've read two or three of those comments that are very harsh and will stay in that speech bubble for days. I have to tell them, you know, a million people have watched this video. You know, some of them didn't like it, but that's like 20 people out of a million, and there's a whole bunch that did like it. So, but in general, that is the biggest problem of comments for me, is those third parties who are often who are always almost volunteers,
mm-hmm.
And not the sort of people that have put themselves out there for criticism. They're doing me a favor.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing the viewers a favor by lending their expertise and knowledge. And suddenly they're exposed to this harsh world. And, you know, I can accept that myself. If someone wants to say that I'm a terrible filmmaker or a bad person or have a big nose or am rubbish, mm-hmm. I have to accept that. You know, I've chosen this world. But these other people, I don't think they've chosen it to the same degree, and I feel quite protective of them.
Yeah.
And it has just very recently reached a tipping point for me where I'm no longer willing to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly with the new comment system and a few other things that have been going on, like it's become very vicious towards these volunteers. And, you know, I can accept if someone says, I disagree with your argument, or I think you made a factual mistake, or,
mm-hmm.
but if they start saying things that are personally offensive or racist or, you know, or sexual against these volunteers, and I can't police it, you know, I can't police it all because there are so many videos.
Mm-hmm.
I've just had enough. And so just recently I'm experimenting with having the comments to approval,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge rod for my own back. I remember when I met with the guys that do the Sesame Street YouTube videos, they do the same thing because obviously lots of kids are on those sites. And I'm very aware that schools use my videos too.
Yeah.
And I don't want the top comment to be some racist attack against the person who's in the video. So I've been experimenting with approving them, and it takes me loads of time. And I'm not particularly censorious in terms of, you know, if someone doesn't like the video, mm-hmm. I don't care. I'll just, you know, tick, I'll prove that. If they like the video, I'll tick it. If they are being abusive, you know, I can't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because it also, some of these people in the videos, you know, are reading it and they've become scared to read the comments.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, they say, no, I won't even look at the comments now. It's too hurtful. And I don't want that to happen. I want them to go into the comments so they can enjoy the praise, or they can look at the constructive criticism and think about it. And, you know, I've always really prided the comment section under my videos as a place where debate goes on. You know, it can be vigorous debate, but, you know, a healthy place. And I like the people in the videos to go in there too and at least read it. Some of them actually engage with it and write comments too, but at least read it and be part of it, so those people writing the comments don't feel like they're talking to the void. But it got to a point where that just wasn't feasible anymore. So I've gone down this approval route as an experiment for now, and I've now been able to go to the people in my videos and say, don't worry, don't be scared of going into the comments anymore. If someone writes something that is horrific, I'll try to stop it.
Because, yeah.
I know we live in a world where free speech is greatly valued, and I greatly value free speech as well, but they can go and do their free speech somewhere else free, not on a video and page that I've created, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm given the administration rights of that page for various reasons. And, you know, if they want to have their free speech and say something vicious and horrible about some poor academic who's volunteered their time, go and do it on your own page.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ride the audience that have come to see a video that we've created.
Yeah. I mean, I would guess, you know, this is a function of audience size.
Yes.
Right. And so obviously, like, as your videos have grown more popular and you have more people subscribed, you can do nothing but expect the average comment quality to go down. It's like a mathematical function. Like you're almost guaranteed that is going to be the case. That is, as you widen the pool, the discussion quality drops. And you know, when, like you say, when you bring in some third party who is not necessarily used to that, it can be a very upsetting experience. And I do think that, you know, at least for YouTube, you know, don't read the comments is not bad advice, and it's partly because the barrier to commenting is much lower, yeah. it is easier, and I don't know about you approving the comments, because my only guess is that as your channel continues to grow, that fundamental underlying math is not going to be any different.
Yeah.
Right. And like you're, maybe it's just handleable now, but in a year
from
now.
It's not. I mean, okay. I need to work on some different solutions. And there are filters and things you can put in place, but it's just a temporary experiment while I figure out how to protect these people I care about.
And the thing that is the tricky thing with feedback, which again is advice for anybody who makes stuff on the internet. This advice is like probably the best advice that I can give about negative feedback, and particularly aggressively negative feedback, but also sometimes the most hard to follow through with. And it is just do not engage, right? You have nothing to gain from engaging with extremely negative commenters. But it is also just so hard not to do. I don't want to go into any details, but I would just say, like, I ran into a very negative commenter on Reddit recently who doesn't like me for personal reasons, you know, doesn't know me, but like, you know, just hates me. Mm. And it's like, man, you just want to respond. But I literally had to sit there and think, like, do not engage, right? You have nothing to gain from this except losing your time. But it is very frustrating. And I can see sometimes on the internet that, like, little conversations unfold where people wonder, like, ooh, why hasn't this prominent person responded about this particular attack on them? And it's like, because the correct answer is do not engage. Like, you just, you can't win fighting.
Never start a land war in Asia.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
That's
right?
What I say about it.
Yeah. And like, negative and or crazy comments are like a land war in Asia, right? Like, you're not going to win on this one, right? There's no way to come out.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of reasons to not engage. Like, one is, it just validates someone who you shouldn't really be validating.
Yeah.
But also, like, they're a stranger. Like, there are lots of people in your life who are important, who should get your time or your light bulbs or whatever you want to give them. And there are people who you shouldn't. And they're also, they don't know you. They don't know anything about you. You've just got to remember they're strangers. That's what I always get told as well. Yeah. Whether they're saying you're great and you make the best videos in the world, or they're saying you're terrible and you're rubbish and they hate your guts, both of those people, they don't know you. And you're not that great. You're not as good as they say. Mm-hmm. And you're not bad as they say. And you just got to just keep doing what you're doing and doing what you enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of those comments are definitely true, that you're not as awesome or as terrible as people say. But it is so hard not to read the comments sometimes. But, you know, I do value feedback and hearing what people have to say.
Yes.
You know, sort of in particular circumstances. And that's why I use Reddit so heavily. For me, that works really well. And it's very interesting to see.
It is a really good thing about our job that we get the level of feedback we do. Like, a lot of people who do jobs and no one ever tells them anything about whether they like what they're doing or don't like what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And we are lucky, and we'll sit here whinging because it comes with a sting in the tail. Mm-hmm. But overall, I quite like it. I will say one other thing about comments, though, that just popped into my head that drives me crazy.
Tell me, Brady.
And that is, inevitably, things will come up in a video, like, say, a mistake or something that kind of needs something that needs addressing or something that someone's noticed, and there is nothing you could do to stop people commenting on that. If you like clarify something with an annotation, or you write something in the description, or you write a bunch of comments in the comment section yourself to say, look, I realize that this isn't clear or something, you will still have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people pointed out as if no one else has pointed it out, like they've just seen it and written it. And it does make me wonder what percentage of people who write comments even glance at the video description or the other people's comments before they write something. It might not even be a mistake. It might be, what is the piece of music you used? Yeah. And you write a comment about it, and everyone else will say, oh, he's used this piece of music, and you'll put it in the, you'll do everything you can to let people, it could be in the video, burned into the video in big bold letters, and you'll still have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people writing, what was the music? Or do you realize this is wrong or something?
You're wondering who these people are, but I know that I have done this myself.
Okay.
I have definitely sometimes left a comment on something only seconds later to see that it was in the description or something, and just feel like a total idiot.
I would never, well, I probably do it all the time, but I would be reluctant to write a comment and put something into writing until I've checked.
Yeah,
that it's not available.
Maybe you're not as reactionary as I can be on the internet, right? Just let the keyboard fly, like, hey, buddy, what's this? And then like, oh, right, he told me 3 seconds later.
Okay.
I was just looking as a final thing here, right? I'm looking at our feedback on our own podcast. And our star ratings follow exactly what I was saying before.
Yeah.
So we have at this point 295 five-star ratings.
Wow, that sounds impressive.
It does sound impressive. I don't have any sense really of how.
No, I got you know, no idea. Like, that could be.
I have no idea what that. But let's just, that's the number, 295 five-star ratings, and then we have 3 one-star ratings.
Right.
And even just looking at that, right, it's like, and we have no 3-star ratings and 5 4-star ratings. Right?
But do you know what? The only ones I want to read are what the 3-star people rate.
Yes,
that's the only one I want to read. Yeah. I want to know what they said.
That is exactly it, right? Like, I'm looking at this, and like your mind, you cannot help it, but like my mind is totally drawn immediately to those 3 1-star ratings. Like, what did that person have to say?
Yeah.
And
it's like when you're booking a holiday, like at some amazing resort in the Maldives, and it has 10,000 5-star reviews and 1 1-star review.
Yeah.
And you read the 1-star review and they say the service was terrible and there were rats. And you're like, well, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to that resort, despite the thousands of people who said it was the most wonderful place they've ever been.
Oh, I almost forgot. I just want to mention this before we sign off. This is the thing that got me started about this whole topic. I forget until the absolute very end.
Hmm.
But going back to what you were saying in the beginning, how you have to trust your own judgment about something.
Yeah.
I was looking at the comments for this podcast, and this happened to be on YouTube because I was curious to see what everybody had to say. And the favorite thing that I came across was 2 comments, one that was right after another. And so this is on YouTube. And the first one is from a guy called Toxis. And he complains, his suggestion is that he doesn't like the podcast because we don't let the conversation flow naturally, and you know we're sticking strictly to our theme. Right. So this is his feedback. He doesn't like it because we're too strictly sticking to the theme.
Well, he would love today's episode.
yeah. But immediately after, there's a user called Unpronounceable, and he has the exact reverse feedback. Right, he doesn't like it because we're just talking about whatever, and you should really have some kind of centralizing theme, right, to focus the discussion.
There you go.
And this is the kind of thing that can just drive you crazy on the internet. Yeah. Is but I love it. I love it that they are literally one right after the other, feedback going in just completely opposite directions.
I make little screen grabs when that happens. I collect some comments. I didn't discuss this actually, but I collect some comments for various reasons. One of the main reasons is I often go and give talks to people about YouTube, and having a nice collection of comments, good and bad, is, you know, quite good for PowerPoint presentations. But whenever I see 2 side by side like that, I like to keep them as little like little twin primes or something. They're nice little treasures when 2 people say exact opposite things back to back. I find that happens a lot when I do the polarizing videos, like something different, like a song or something like that. That's when you get, this is the best video I've ever seen on the internet, followed by this is the worst piece of trash I've ever seen. Yes. You should die.
Those pairs are just great. And so we have one of those for this podcast.
Excellent.
It is both too structured and not structured enough. Which is why you have to make decisions eventually.
How do we fix that? What do we do now? I don't know.
Well, here's what I'm going to do right now. So, and this is also a cunning plan. I have left this to last for a very reason, right? So, we have a bunch of reviews from different countries around the world, and so here's the list of places where we have gotten reviews.
Yeah.
It's Argentina, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Greece, Ireland, Mexico, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Saudi Arabia, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, and the United States. So what I would like is to get more different countries, right? This to me is like Pokemon, right? Like you got to catch them all. I would love to eventually at some point have a review from every one of the countries where this podcast can be heard. So if you're hearing the sound of my voice right now, and if you like this podcast, which if you have listened this long, you must like this podcast. And if you are listening this long and you don't like this podcast, I'm very worried. But I'm going to assume anybody who has listened this long, by definition, has to be enjoying this podcast. And you are from one of the places that I have not mentioned. I would really like you to go leave a review in iTunes.
Even if it's a one star?
I'm assuming the people who have listened this long are going to leave positive reviews.
I so should have put a review in when I was in Vietnam.
You should have, yes, I guess. I'm not exactly sure how that works. That's okay.
Okay, but anyway, the message is out there. Gray has spoken.
So I want to see if we can collect all, and unfortunately, I can't just tally up how many countries there are. And of course, my own video on the number of countries means it's ambiguous anyway. Yes. But there are a bunch of places. So if you can hear my voice and you were not, or you are in a place that was not mentioned, I would love it if you left a review. And maybe next time I'll follow up and see how many additional places we have gotten since that last time. But I'm going to say, I think this has been long enough, my friend.
I think, although I feel like I didn't ask enough questions and I spoke too much, but I'll do more questions next time.
No, it's good. We'll be chatting. But you know what? People will complain both ways. We'll get feedback that people loved it and feedback that people didn't like it. And I guess we'll just have to make some judgments about that.
See you later, mate.
All right. Talk again.
Bye.
All right. Bye.